across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. Thank you very much for your great feedback to Controversial Edition 40 of The Unexplained. I know that subject is very hard for a lot of people to find palatable, but what I did say is if you want me to get that man Michael Horn back on again to talk about the Billy Meyer prophecies, and if you want me to put harder questions to him than the ones I put, questions directly from you, email me here. And if I get enough of them together and there's enough interest together, then we'll get him back on and we will try and understand a little bit more about all of this stuff and put your concerns and your points to him. But that was edition 40, and edition 39 still bringing in good response too. That was the session with Seth Shostak from SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute. So a couple of good and well-responded to shows there. Thank you again for the donations. Please, please keep those coming in. They're vital to this work. The fact that I'm able to sit here doing this now is now down to your donations. You know, there's a lot of mythology about people who work as I've worked all my life in radio. Most people, and if you work in or around radio, and I know I've got a lot of radio insiders, certainly in the US and the UK, listening to this show, you know that for most people who work in radio, none of us get rich, okay? And some of us are living, you know, lives that don't have a lot of money around them. And one or two people do make fortunes, but most people don't. We do it for love. We do it for fulfillment more than anything else. So in order to sustain this independent work that is not dictated to or produced by some big corporation, it is purely between you and me, this effort. Please make a donation. You can do that on the front page of this website, www.theunexplained.tv. Also, the new iPhone function on the website is going very, very well. Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot, my wonderful and highly talented web guy, has devised a way that you can listen to this show and every edition of this show on the iPhone or the iPod Touch. You can find out about that on the front page of the website, www.theunexplained.tv. Some great emails, by the way. Some from North America, a lot from the UK. Guy in Malta, too, talking about that paranormal experience a friend of mine says she had when she was there. He's going to do some research about that. So you can see the tentacles of this show are spreading wider and wider. And I'm always knocked out by the ability of the show to reach people and to get response back. Now I think we're cooking. This is what I wanted when I set this thing up 4 years ago, and I think we're getting there. And with your help, we will get there. Okay, on the show this time, it is a visit from an old friend. I say a visit, it's a visit to an old friend, a man called Michael Tellinger in South Africa. Very exciting time for Michael. His work is reaching critical mass. I think it was edition 15 or 16, without checking back directly right now. That's the one he was on where I actually sat in his home in South Africa talking to him about his work. Well, he's got an update right now. Michael Tellinger, going to cross to him now in Mpumalanga, South Africa. Thank you for coming on The Unexplained, and as they say in South Africa, how's it? See, I've got it's all the
very,
phrases.
Very well.
How's it, by the way, if you're in North America, wherever you are, is what's... I've been trying to tell my friends up here, Michael, during the World Cup a couple of months back, that the word how's it means hi. How you doing? That's what it is, isn't it, really? Is it like that? Is
yeah,
that what
exactly.
I'm, yeah.
Well, how's it? I suppose, well, you know, you should know that being sort of, you know, responsible for colonizing South Africa and Australia. I suppose that the cricket expression, how's that, is closely related, you know, because how's that is really how is it, umpire? Is he in or is he out?
Well, I tell you, the other thing they say in South Africa that you've got to get, there are a few, not many things. You use most of the same phrases that we use up here. But sometimes you'll be having a conversation and you'll tell somebody something that they are amazed by or they can't quite believe. And they'll say, is it?
That's right.
And you have to say, it is.
Yeah, all my English friends are always mesmerized by that expression. You know, is it? It's like, you know, you're agreeing with a person or you're amazed at what he's saying. It's like, it's just a short sort of expression of that the fact that you're listening and you're participating in the debate and the thought process and you're contemplating it and you're saying, oh, is that so? That's interesting and fascinating and I'm trying to digest what it is you're telling me.
Sure beats, really.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I think I'm going to be saying, is it, a few times in this conversation. You and I last spoke when you were living in the poshest part of Africa, the richest square mile, I think it is, Sandton, near Johannesburg. You're not there anymore.
Well, I'm not. Actually, I didn't live there. At that stage, I had already sold my house in Johannesburg and moved out to where I'm living now in Mpumalanga, in the mountains of Mpumalanga, right in the heart of the ancient civilizations that we've been exploring and discovering. And the last time we spoke, you came to my girlfriend's apartment. And we did the interview there, yeah.
Okay, well, now I know Mpumalanga, and I know it to be... Mpumalanga reminds me almost, and this might sound strange to you, but it's almost like the countryside where Stonehenge is in Wiltshire. It is a place where you have these big open fields. There's a certain amount of up and down there too, of course. We have to say hills and all that kind of stuff. But there are these big, open, ancient-looking fields with rocks strewn all around the place. And that was what struck me about Mpumalanga when I was there last year. It kind of looks like a rougher, more outdoors version of Wiltshire, less manicured version of Wiltshire in the UK, which is interesting because, as you know, Wiltshire's the home of Stonehenge. There's a lot of history there, and there's an awful lot of supposed UFO contact and crop circles and all the rest of it. So I wonder if just the appearance of it is where the similarity stops.
Well, you know, you also, Mpumalanga is also where a large part of the Kruger Park is. It's what's known as the low veld. It gets very hot there. And you got the bush veld there as well, the low veld, bush veld, which is quite dense in places. And you also have the northern tip of the Drakensberg, actually, which is where I'm in. I'm in the very mountainous area. And then, large parts of Mpumalanga are actually quite mountainous.
Right. I didn't know the Drakensbergs, which is, I mean, if you're listening in North America or even in the UK, the Drakensbergs, you have to go and see. Beautiful, beautiful area. They start kind of is it northish? It's in from Durban. Anyway, you've got to drive about 3 hours, 4 hours out of Durban. And then you're into it for a large portion of a long drive all the way up towards places like names that we'll know here in the UK, Ladysmith and Mafeking. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And and basically all along the coast from the Eastern Cape right up through KZN, KwaZulu-Natal, and into the southern Mpumalanga section, and along Swaziland and so forth. The Drakensberg run all along there. And also, for those people that have watched the movie 2012, right at the end, they say, you know, at 2012, the one place you want to be, if you want to be safe, is in South Africa, in the Drakensberg. So here we are, in the Drakensberg, awaiting 2012.
Are you serious about that? Is that why you're there, not just because it's a real beautiful place to be?
Well, I believe that things don't just happen accidentally. I believe there's an order and a reason for things. And there's obviously a real reason why I was brought here, why fate had brought me here. With our discoveries of the ancient vanished civilizations, and this seems to be one of the most dense areas of those vanished civilizations. And since we last spoke, we have made huge new discoveries that we can talk about.
Because you're about to take some of this stuff on the road, and I know you're due to do a big tour of the United States, which will be enormous for you, on top of all the publishing and speaking work that you already do. The last time we spoke, we started from a premise that would seem outrageous to people up here, and we explained why you were making that case, that the Bantu people, the people we know as being the indigenous or supposedly indigenous South Africans, the ones who've been there longest, is what I'm trying to say here, were in fact not the first there, even though they might claim they might, which is an outrageous assertion to make. And you explained why. I wonder if in just a minute or so you can take me through that again.
Yeah, you know, it gets quite complicated, and very easily one can slip into a whole racial debate and an argument here, which is not what this is about. This is about tracing our origins, our human origins, to a place where we come from, all of us, that all humans come from, Homo sapiens. And it seems that Southern Africa is that place. Who those early and those first humans were, we don't really know. What they looked like, we don't really know. We suspect they were probably much closer to the Bushmen, or what we call the Bushmen, or the Khoisan people today. We suspect that they were probably more like those. And then later, started developing into different race groups, which is a whole nother debate, because just like we have a theory of human evolution, which remains a theory, and just to remind people, and we also have absolutely no idea where the different race groups on Earth come from. And the current scientific stand, or stand of historians and anthropologists, is absolutely nonsensical, and it's like telling somebody that Father Christmas exists and insisting on that.
Now, the other strange hypothesis which I found, which I took away with me, and I thought about a lot since, was that those people who were there, tell me if I'm wrong here, because it's a while since we had that conversation, and I have to say I deliberately didn't play it back again, because I want to do a fresh conversation with you now. I don't want to be influenced by all that. But was that the people who were there in South Africa at the time were servicing some other civilization with much greater intelligence, with something that they needed, and the something that they needed was something South Africa has always had, and that something is gold, yeah?
Correct. And that's important to talk about right up front. Gold is really the main reason why humanity is on Earth, and why the human race, Homo sapiens, have taken over and colonized this planet. And gold is, in my research, one of the sort of three common denominators that you cannot separate from human origins. It's just not possible. You know, for those that know your Bible, even in Genesis 2, shortly after God has created Adam, or as the Sumerian tablets call him, Adamu, Adam is alone on earth. Eve does not even exist. And already God displays his love for the shiny thing called gold. When he tells Adam, I want to take you to the land of Havilah, where there is the land is good, the water is good, and there is gold. For people that have done their research and do a lot of broad reading will know that the story and the fairy tale of human history that we've been told in our history books and we get taught in school and university is just so far off the track that it actually becomes laughable the more research you do.
All right, well, you've done more research since we last talked. You're going to blow, as we say here, and I think they say down there too, you're going to blow their socks off when you go to America. Let's get into your current research and the work that you're dealing with now.
Yeah, Howard, we've got now, finally, we can say with absolute surety that, or certainty, that we are now sitting on the physical evidence that many authors and many researchers and alternative historians have been writing about and talking about for decades, hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. And that evidence is the physical evidence of the first humans on Earth, the first Homo sapiens, the first emergence of humans on Earth around 300,000 years ago, their very vast settlements, and the activity that they were all engaged in, and that was the mining of gold. And it is surrounded, we are surrounded by it here in Southern Africa, that's basically most of South Africa, all of Zimbabwe, large parts of Botswana. It goes across the Zambezi from Zimbabwe into Zambia, large parts of Mozambique. And this whole Southern African region was the headquarters of an ancient gold mining operation that we read about extensively in the Sumerian tablets. And now we're sitting on the physical evidence of those early human civilizations.
As far as you can tell me, then, what is this physical evidence? What have you found?
Well, millions of ancient stone ruins, very, very large stone settlements, larger than any modern-day metropolis. And this is just mind-blowing stuff that people cannot imagine. You know, imagine London, you know, three or four times the size. And that's what we're dealing with here and scattered throughout Southern Africa, not just once, but several times. We're dealing with probably at least 10 million ancient stone structures. We're dealing with thousands and thousands of
Hold up, 10 million?
Correct.
10 million stone structures?
Yes. So now just that one statement should send shivers up the spine of any historian, anthropologist, or archaeologist, because no one has been able to make these assertions that we're making now, assumptions, because they did not have the information that we have now. And it's taken 3 years of hardcore research by, well, Jan Heine and various others, and especially myself, when I entered the arena and I started looking at these stone structures from a slightly different perspective and a more of a scientific perspective, because I like to think of myself as an astute scientist, and looking at the evidence that we have and starting to count these stone structures with the help of the scientific tools that we have, like Google, which no one else has done before. And when you know what you're looking for on the ground, when you know what it looks like on the ground, and to know what it looks like on the ground, you've got to do the work. You've got to walk the talk. So you've got to climb the mountains and walk through the bushes and see what these things look like on the ground, under the trees, and realize that even though there's grass and trees, that the stone ruins continue, that they don't stop. And only then can you start extrapolating and doing the number crunching to realize, shock of horrors, that we're dealing with more than 10 million stone structures.
Now, if you were to look at this with a northern hemisphere eye, and it was my first thought as you were talking then, and I can understand why I had the thought, and I can also understand why other people will be having that thought, you have to get out of that northern hemisphere perspective that everybody knows most things about everything, that, you know, everything is there to be found, and we've probably found most of it by now. This is Africa we're talking about, TIA, like you say down there. And things can be left undisturbed and undiscovered and unseen and unappreciated forever. So this is not the northern hemisphere we're talking about. Am I right when I make that statement?
You're spot on, and that's exactly what has happened. Although we've had a few fair warnings by some smart people, individuals in the past, in the last 200 years or so, who have made very important discoveries, their discoveries have gone fairly unnoticed and then forgotten. And one such person, in my opinion, was the brilliant British archaeologist, whose name just escapes me. It'll come back to me.
But he was certainly brilliant.
he was brilliant. And he did, Theodore Bent is his name.
Okay.
Theodore Bent. He did major excavations here in Southern Africa, throughout South Africa, Botswana, Zimbabwe, and beyond. He was also, he did a lot of work in Egypt and in the Near East. And he estimated in 1891 already that there were at least 4,000 stone structures, stone ruins. But then the obsession with this goes back many, many, many centuries ago to the arrival of the Portuguese. And when the Portuguese arrived here in the late 1400s, they already started writing about these vanished cities and these mysterious stone ruins that the local indigenous people, the Bantu people, knew nothing about. They didn't know who built them. They didn't know where they came from, but they occupied some of them and then they avoided the others. And they actually, when they were asked by the Portuguese explorers who built these structures, they were told that they did not know. And it must be the work of the devil because man can't build structures like this.
And if it was the work of the devil, then I would imagine in those times, and we have to say that South Africa is still a very religious country in so many ways, so many different ways. If that's the case, then the best thing to do about it is probably just to quietly forget all about it.
Yeah, but you know what else they discovered? The Portuguese started discovering these African cultures, and this is what becomes very interesting, because it seems like the African tradition and the African culture goes back so far, way beyond to what we today see as the Bantu tribes in Southern Africa. That knowledge, that indigenous knowledge, the belief systems and the cultural references to ancestors and the way things were goes back many thousands of years, way before the seeming arrival of the Bantu people in Southern Africa. And that causes very interesting complications. So it's really an interesting pool of confusion that is developing here. What we do know is that our current history books teach us absolutely nonsensical and give us nonsensical information. And they tell us fairy tales that somebody somewhere along the line pulled out of a hat. They made up stuff because they had really didn't have enough information. And we are told that Southern Africa was a very sparsely populated part of the world before about 1,000 years ago.
What about all this stuff that tourists, when they go to South Africa, are faced with? You have an awful lot of stuff like there's that place that, Marupeng. That's right. Yeah, I've been there a couple of times, and of course I forgot the name to, but it's Marupeng, and they call it the cradle of civilization. You go down into the caverns and caves there, and they tell you this is where it all began. Is that not so? Is that part of the paradigm?
No, that's all right. That's all lies, you see, unfortunately, and that's how they confuse people. It's a very convenient little word that they forget to tell you. They sell that as the cradle of humankind, but they into that that definition, they very cleverly work in the fact their theory of evolution of the humankind, and they just suppose and sell as fact that humans evolved out of these ape-like creatures. Okay, and they show you these, you know, these ape-like creatures, and the more upright creature, and the more upright creature, and bingo, suddenly there's humans. Well, that's nonsense. It's a theory of evolution that has never been proven, and it needs to stay a theory of evolution because it'll never be proven, because humans did not evolve out of those creatures. There is no evidence for that. There's far more scientific evidence for humans suddenly appearing on planet Earth as some sort of an act of genetic manipulation, and that is the evidence that we have. So this whole theory of evolution is what they confuse people with. And when people don't do their research or they don't read this kind of material, they get confused. And they say, well, you see, this is where we come from, honey. You know, once we were apes and now we, you know, flying to the stars.
And you're saying what? You're saying it's a more abrupt process than that and we were put here.
Absolutely. And we were put here by very, very advanced beings that arrived on planet Earth. They were known as the Anunnaki. If you read your Sumerian tablets and you'll get the full story of it. And why historians have this selective approach to the information in Sumerian tablets really beats me. Well, it doesn't beat me. It's fully understandable because these guys fear for their jobs. They fear for security. And if you are in any way linked to any tertiary institution in the world, and you start saying to your students and teaching your students that we were genetically manipulated as a slave species to mine, work in the gold mines of Southern Africa.
They're going to laugh at you.
By an advanced group of beings called the Anunnaki, they're going to fire you. But these guys, these poor guys that sit at universities, spewing forth the crap that is written in the history books of the past, are just propagating the lie. So the lie gets propagated more and more and more, and has become such a fairy tale that it's laughable.
Well, you know, we can't take a view on this show, so I have to listen to what people have to say, and I have to let the audience decide what they think about it. But just to my small brain, what you're telling me makes a more comfortable fit with what we see in places like Egypt.
Yeah.
With the pyramids. Absolutely. And with the South American civilizations and with all the rest of it, because they are a weird link that doesn't seem to fit in with the rest of what I was taught in school.
Exactly. I mean, the Sumerian civilization is supposed to be the first civilization on Earth. That's what we get taught. And now with the many translations of the Sumerian tablets, the historians keep telling us that we inherited everything we know today from the Sumerians. You know, our knowledge of astronomy, astrology, medicine, architecture, agriculture, mathematics, everything from the Sumerians. But when they get to the point where the Sumerians talk about the Anunnaki, incidentally, the same group of people that the Bible calls the Anakim, or the giants, okay, same group of people, suddenly the historians say, no, we can't go there, we can't believe that, because that's a bit too far-fetched, because it tells us that the Anunnaki genetically manipulated the humans to be their slaves, and they don't feel comfortable with that. So, you know, wake up, grow up, face the music, and, you know, get on with life, for God's sake.
Well, this is your life's work, and you have a vested interest, of course, in promulgating all of this. Huh. What stage do you think you are at in this work? How far into it are you now?
Well, it's happening so quickly now, Howard. It's because the discoveries that we're making with these stone ruins are so startling and so overwhelming that what has happened is we've split the academia down the middle. We've split the scientists from the archaeologists. And I must add very quickly here, archaeologists are not scientists. They're not recognized as scientists, so please keep that in mind. So when I start sharing my findings and my discoveries with scientists, and I'm talking about chemists, physicists, astrophysicists, quantum physicists, electrical engineers, and so forth, they absolutely go crazy. They get it, they understand it, and they agree with everything and all my theories. While the so-called archaeologists and the non-scientific fraternities, they don't get it, they don't understand it. and they keep falling on the old textbooks and the stuff they were taught at school and at university. Well, you're not going to make any progress if you keep falling on back on that, because this information is not in those textbooks. So you need to move beyond those textbooks and look at the new discoveries.
And within these ruins that you've been finding, what sorts of things are there? What sorts of messages are there, both implicit messages and perhaps written down or recorded messages are there?
Well, this is where it becomes difficult. And the messages are none. There are no messages. And you have to look for very small clues, pieces of evidence that you start putting together, definitely like a very broad ancient puzzle of human history.
But isn't that a problem, though, that is where your interpretation comes into it, and that's where all the trouble starts, isn't it?
No, not at all. At this stage, it's not interpretation. It's scientific hardcore fact, and I'm going to tell you why I say that. First of all, we're dealing with specific stones that were. When I tell you that it took us how many years, probably 30 years of research since Theodore Bent, actually. So we're dealing with over 100 years of research, and those before him that came looking at these ruins in southern Africa. It took us all this time for me to finally come along and realize that all these ancient stone ruins were built with one specific stone. Okay, now that is huge, a huge discovery. The fact that they only used one kind of stone.
Over how wide an area?
The whole of southern Africa.
Gee whiz. Okay.
Okay. So now immediately you start going, okay, hold on. This is not just some random grouping of people building stone structures here. Secondly, the fact that these stones have a very specific homogeneous properties of silica dioxide, iron and aluminium and a bit of manganese, they all ring like bells and they were chosen for their acoustic properties. Very important discovery. And I might add, for those listeners of yours who know Stonehenge, will also know that the giant stones at Stonehenge, Saracen stones, and probably the blue stone as well, were chosen for their acoustic properties. Very important link and connection to these two civilizations.
Why?
Because they used sound as an energy source, and that is really the major discovery we've made. Many of the tools that we find do not fall into the sort of standard archaeological recognized tools. They're completely different. They're not chipped, carved, or shaped. They seem to be molded into very specific shapes. And the shapes that we find very strange are the conical, very conical, like an ice cream cone kind of shape, bulbous at the one end and down to a very fine point. And we get them in all shapes and sizes, from small ones that fit into your hand to very large ones that you can hardly pick up. All shaped from the same stone. We're talking about the same, it's called Hornfels, named after a German geologist.
So if all this stuff was made from the same stone and everything was all over southern Africa, presumably this stone has one resonant frequency, works in exactly the same way wherever you put it. It's just like some kind of microchip thing, and will achieve the same result wherever it is. But what's that result?
That result is that they pick up the frequency of planet Earth, and they resonate a specific frequency based on the shape of the circle. Just like in cymatics, the study of sound, we get different frequencies, generate different shapes. And this is what we're dealing with. These guys knew that the Earth rings like a bell, what Nikola Tesla reminded us of in the late 1800s already. The Earth rings like a bell. And those sound frequencies from inside planet Earth can be picked up and represented on the surface of planet Earth. And that representation we see in the structures of these millions of stone ruins.
Now, what would be amazing is if those structures and those shapes and those forms were replicated somewhere else in our universe. Wouldn't that be
amazing?
Well,
not only that, what's even amazing, Howard, is now we're starting to see that these guys understood the sound frequency principle way much, much better than we do today, and they use it as a source of energy. Scientifically, when you start looking at this huge establishment and settlement of these stone structures, that screams at you immediately. If you know anything about sound, frequencies, harmonics, electronics, wave patterns, that's the first thing that hits you. My God, these guys were using sound as an energy source. Then we went and we started looking at the very strange and ominous presence of these thousands of miles of what we originally called roads. Every one of these original stone circles, now remember, most of the original stone circles, if not all of them, don't have any entrances. They have no entrances. Okay, now that is obviously a very huge problem.
Well, I would have thought so. How'd you get into them?
Exactly. So you've got to immediately discount places, you know, that were built by later civilizations or reconstructed. And you can see many examples of reconstruction of these earlier, the original structures by later civilizations, by the Hindu Dravidians that came here mining gold probably 4,000 years ago already. So they had a huge impact on the southern African civilization. The Bantu tribes that came here from northern Africa, and then you start seeing the influences of all these different groups that probably used, well, not probably, that we can clearly see used many of these stone structures, but only a small, very small fraction of them when they came upon them. And they built their mud huts and their grass huts inside these stone structures, but were not responsible for the original construction. And remember, once again, and I keep reminding our archaeological friends, rule number one in archaeology is civilizations build on top of each other, and use and evidence of use does not mean evidence of construction. And please keep that in mind. And so now we see that all these ancient original stone circles were connected by thousands and thousands of miles of what we originally called roads, made of the same stone. And we start seeing, hold on, these aren't roads. So now we don't call them roads anymore. We call them channels. And now we start seeing a very clear pattern emerging. If these guys used a sound frequency, it comes from planet Earth. They knew how to generate and cultivate and use the sound frequency, just like Nikola Tesla did on Long Island.
So they had the internet in their own way. They had the internet.
They had not only the internet, but they could use the sound frequency and the sound energy to generate it, amplify it to very, very high levels of amplification and frequency so that you could do all kinds of things with it. And this is where it becomes really way mind-blowing for people that think small and think in a box. They use that energy to do the mining with, to transport things with, levitation, to drill with, to crush the rocks, to separate the metals from each other, all done with frequency.
Fabulous. Amazing. Where are they now? Okay. Why did they disappear?
Well, they didn't disappear. Are you talking about the people or the stone ruins?
I'm talking about the creators.
Oh, the creators are still here. But let me finish this, because the reason I can say this with absolute certainty, because we've measured this energy, and we know that it's still there. It is still alive. We've measured the energy at 14.5 gigahertz, which is very, very high frequency, coming out of the stone ruins at 72 decibels, on average 72 decibels. We need to do a lot more measurement, but this is our initial measurement. Not only, so it means these stone circles are still generating energy, they're alive and well and kicking, and they are an inexhaustible source of energy for us. There they are.
That's all 14.5 gigahertz. That's almost like microwave radiation.
It is. It's more than that. It's you know, it's starting to approach, you know, satellite broadcasting frequencies.
This is astonishing. So this was all here. This was all in place. Africa was the heart of it all.
Yeah.
And, but I don't think scientists are going to buy any of this. But you're starting to get the evidence, like the 14.2 gigahertz, that they cannot deny.
Well, the scientists are buying it. It's the archaeologists that can't wrap their heads around it, and you know, so be it. That's their problem. I really don't care. Our scientific evidence is hardcore. It's scientific. It's irrefutable. There it is. And if you ask any scientist, the structures, the layout of this ancient, vast, ancient metropolis and this vast ancient settlement in southern Africa is all about gold. We also have the evidence from other geological formations, which I'll tell you about now, and discoveries. It's all about gold, and this gold has been mined here for 270,000 years. And then what wiped it out was what we all know was the major geographical disaster, which the Bible talks about as the Great Flood. The Sumerian tablets talk about as the deluge and also the flood. And there was definitely an event about 13,000 years ago that pretty much destroyed the planet and wiped out this entire ancient civilization here in southern Africa.
This is a stupid question, but it's not the first one I've asked. If this civilization was so damn clever, how come they didn't avoid their fate?
Well, they did avoid their fate. The Anunnaki avoided their fate. The Anunnaki retreated. They went up. They sat it out in their little spaceships up in the atmosphere, watched it go down. And when the flood water subsided, they came down and they restarted the civilization. And that's why after 30,000 years ago, the biblical flood, God comes down from his spaceship and he sees the survivors, Noah and these cronies in Sumerian tablets. He's known as Zeusudra. And God has an interaction with Zeusudra. Remember, the Sumerian tablets are the predecessors to the Bible. And therefore, the names in the Bible are actually changed from the Sumerian, original Sumerian scripts. And God interacts. God was not God, the divine being, the creator of the universe. I'm not talking about God with a small g, the creator of the human race, the group of Anunnaki advanced beings that just knew the art of genetic manipulation like we do today. We clone animals, cats, dogs, all that stuff. You can reclone your pet if you want to. So, you know, let's not be naive and think, you know, that this has not happened in the past. Of course it has.
And do the Anunnaki have any significance to us here in this technological world that we have with our internet and all the other technology that we depend on and is getting so advanced?
Well, and now suddenly you start very rapidly moving towards what some people call conspiracy theories, which actually has got nothing to do with conspiracy, but really the true history of the world and how the humans then started to be very rapidly manipulated by the remaining Anunnaki on planet Earth, the guys that remained behind and carried on controlling the gold mining operations, and then the new civilizations that started springing up that they were responsible for, seeding in the Americas to mine more gold over there, because the huge geophysical forces that happened that destroyed the planet with the giant flood that emanated from Antarctica, according to the Sumerian tablets once again, those same geophysical forces that pretty much destroyed the world also would have caused the tectonic movement of plates to move and appear in other parts of the world and expose new veins of gold. And therefore, suddenly the gold mining operations also shifted to other parts of the world where before the flood, it was mostly concentrated in southern Africa.
So the flood wasn't, from their point of view, from the Anunnaki's point of view, not entirely a bad thing because it revealed new sources of what they needed.
It was. It destroyed all the huge gold mining operation here, which incidentally, obviously, you realize was also, you know, King Solomon's mines. It exposed, as you say, new veins of gold, and by then they were mining other minerals, iron and everything else you can imagine. And guess what? It hasn't stopped. It's continuing today. And for people that are out there...
Yeah, by whom, though? Who's doing this then today? Who's behind it?
The same group of people. And just because you think that you got a university education and you're smart and they can't pull the wool over your eyes and you will know if this was happening, stop being so bloody arrogant and read widely, open your mind to other histories, to other realities and other possibilities, and you realize that the history of this planet is far stranger than you could have ever possibly imagined.
Are you saying that there is a government behind the government?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. There's a secret government behind every government on the world. They run all the governments in the world. It's the same group that controlled the mining operations in southern Africa and expanded to the rest of the world. It is probably, at this stage, a combination of not just the Anunnaki, but various other extraterrestrial groups that do not have benevolent ideas for planet Earth, but actually are continuing for as long as they want to keep the human race enslaved and keep them as ignorant as possible about the true history and the true, you know, reason why humans are on this planet, and that reason was to be slaves and mining gold. The one very important thing, Howard, is that when they created or they cloned the humans, the early humans, the one thing they had to do, and this is where you have to start researching and reading and being able to read and research as widely as possible. And I mean from hardcore physics to metaphysics, medicine, etc. What they had to do to create a species that can take instructions and perform a function without being tired and tedious and forget what they were doing, you have to give this new species of being a large frontal lobe. And that's where things all sort of fell flat. And the moment you have a large frontal lobe, there will come a time as you evolve and your DNA evolves, there will come a time where you start contemplating your own reality as a species on the planet and the universe. And the moment you start doing that as a species, you've reached a level of consciousness that is unstoppable. And this is what's happened to the human race.
Well, from what you've said, isn't there somebody out there who's going to want to stop that? Because we're getting too clever for ourselves. We're getting too big for our boots.
And they're doing that on a daily basis. What do you think the different the swine flu is? What do you think the bird flu is? What do you think the different black deaths have been throughout the human, you know, the recent memory that we know, you know, reasonably well?
And what about natural disasters? Are they engineered?
There are many of them that are engineered, and that's what HAARP is all about, the high aural thing.
But this is that low-frequency radar, whatever it is, that's generating a pulse signals. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, remember that HAARP, many people are not aware of this. HAARP has got its own nuclear generator, okay, a few hundred meters away from it. A nuclear power station that is there specifically just to power HAARP. And there's some very, very compelling evidence to suggest that very large earthquake in China recently was conducted by the secret authorities, the black government, call them what you want, that was conducted by HAARP. And the reason we can say that is that when you use HAARP on that kind of technology, it creates some very interesting anomalies in the sky prior to the event happening. And, you know, once again, what is this all about? It's all about frequency. What we're beginning to realize now in the research that I'm doing now, and I can't mention names because now we started to get into the areas where people start getting killed.
This is politics.
People disappear from planet Earth. And I now know a group of people that know how to use frequency to cure any disease, any possible disease you can imagine. Okay, and I'm not making this up. We know that sound frequency and this use of frequency can be used as free source of energy. And therefore, when I say that these stone circles and these ancient stone ruins are still alive and kicking, and we have an inexhaustible source of energy, this will and probably can be used with immediate effect to replace the control groups that we have that supply us with energy. Remember, the moment people have free energy in the world, they have pretty much shed 80% of the control by the control groups.
Which is why it's obviously in somebody's interest that we do not learn any of this stuff that you're talking about, because the power generating industry, the political structure, every damn thing depends on things staying exactly as they are.
Exactly. And this is why so much effort has gone into suppressing what Nikola Tesla found out and what John Keely before him found out in 1888, you know, levitating things, drilling holes, crushing stone, disassociating water, all with sound frequencies.
Well, if this is what you have found, and it sounds a very compelling argument to me, and I'm sure to anybody listening to this, unless they're a complete hard heart about the thing, you know, anybody who dreams the dream and thinks the thoughts, they'd be thinking right now, great argument, demonstrate it to me.
Exactly. And that's what we're busy doing right now. So we're setting up some experiments. We're going to boil water with a simple frequency. There's a thing called sonoluminescence. This has been done. Many scientists that have participated in this will recognize that sonoluminescence is where you take a spherical body of water, you expose it to 20 hertz, simple 20 hertz of sound frequency. And after a short period of time, from the center of the body of water, you will start seeing very bright, bright light emanating in all directions, and very, very high temperatures up to, I believe, about 30,000 degrees without destroying any of this emanate. So what we're discovering, Howard, is that the fundamental basic principles of the simplicity of nature, the simple laws of nature that the so-called laws of physics have been trying to uncover and trying to define and trying to justify and trying to explain, but failed miserably.
Well, we've had it all wrong for years, obviously, from what you say.
The laws of nature are the universal laws. Let's use the laws of nature to re-educate ourselves, and don't force our way of stubborn thinking, trying to understand, and if it doesn't fit the laws of physics and does not, you know, it's all rubbish. Physics is a man-made concept. And what we're discovering now, as a result of finding these lost civilizations, The fact that they used an advanced knowledge source of energy, which is sound frequencies, coming out of planet Earth, using the frequencies for everything and anything you can imagine, right? That was their source. And we're now realizing that that's what it is. Frequency is energy, and we can use it to do everything and anything we need to.
But if there's a government behind the government, and if all this stuff has always been going on, and we haven't been smart enough until now to realize that fact, do you honestly believe that the government behind the government and the powers that be are going to let you discover and demonstrate all of this stuff? They're going to try, if we believe this, they're going to try and stop you, aren't they? Maybe they've tried already.
Well, I'm still alive and kicking. Let's see how it goes. If I disappear very shortly, then, you know, they've achieved it.
But the one thing that would persuade most people in this world, on this planet, because we're all fundamentally, all right, we're not that simple, but in our day-to-day appreciation of everything, we are. If you were able to get together with a bunch of people, put together something that generates these frequencies, get a guy with a broken foot, and by the pure power of sound, and there will still be people who will doubt you, of course they will, but by the pure power of sound and the understanding of the laws of nature as you understand them, fix the problem. If you go out and do that, you've proved it all, haven't you?
That's exactly what we're planning to do. The main thing we want to do is boil water with frequency, and I think we're a few weeks, if not a week, away from that.
Well, that's a fabulous start.
Yeah, exactly. Because remember, once you've done that, that is the holy grail. Because once you've boiled water with frequency, you can run your car in it. You can do everything. It's like you don't need solar power. You don't need anything.
Well, let me bring it down to a very low level again, and I'm sorry for this. But, you know, when I was a kid, there used to be ads on TV. You might have had them in SA as well back then, for Memorex tape. Do you remember those ads with Ella Fitzgerald singing? You might not remember this, but they were on TV in the 70s and 80s in this country and in America. Ella Fitzgerald singing a note that was pure enough, high enough, and loud enough to shatter a glass. What I'm saying is, we've always known how to use sound, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly. But slowly and surely and systematically, that kind of way of thinking has been beaten out of us through the so-called education system. And your dear friend David Icke has called it what it is. It's not an education system. It's an indoctrination system. They take children away from their parents for the most important part of their life, and they fill their heads with the biggest load of rubbish and indoctrination and belief systems that they want them to have for their short span of life. So it takes the rest of your life to try and overcome that indoctrination that you've been exposed to as a young child, as a young adult.
Aren't you talking about something that could create some kind of conflict here, though? If more and more people become custodians of this ancient knowledge that's always existed, and there are also a group of individuals who've always been here, who've always known about it, so it's you who've just discovered it, or are just rediscovering it, versus them who've always known it, who probably don't want that knowledge getting out because they're using it and profiting from it. You are talking about war. Isn't that so?
You know, fortunately, the masses of people on planet Earth, compared to the small number of those that control the masses, it's you're talking about, you know, a few thousand people, if that, that are really running this planet.
Yeah, but the masses sit at home and watch America's Got Talent or Pop Idol in the UK or whatever. They're not interested in this stuff. You're talking about galvanizing the masses with some fantastic knowledge. You're going to have to go some to do that, aren't you?
I don't know, Howard. I think the people generally are watching, you know, America Has Got Talent because they are depressed. They have nothing better to do, and no one has given them any sense of hope or any information or knowledge or a message to raise their excitement levels, to make them realize that they can do something, that there is a bright light at the end of the tunnel for humanity, and that they can liberate themselves from the misery that they have been forced into by the capitalists and those that run this planet. The world has never been more ready for this. Now, once again, you have to throw into this the point in time that we are at as the human race. We're approaching 2012, and for those and the prophecies of 2012, and for those that still don't believe it's real, wake up, sit up, pay attention, and, you know, plug in to what's going on.
Well, what's
going
to happen in 2012? Who do you believe? What's going to happen?
Well, what's going to happen is that we're moving towards a very rapid rise in consciousness. And all you have to do, I'm sure you see it, you feel it. First of all, it is scientifically proven. And once again, I'm talking scientifically here, not as somebody's pulling, you know, things out of imagination here. Scientifically proven that our DNA is constantly evolving, and that evolution comes as a result of a specific frequency of light. Once again, we come back to this thing called frequency. Okay, specific frequency of light that activates our DNA and reactivates many of our genes that are dormant. Remember, we only use about 2 to 3% of our DNA. Therefore, that is a very strong argument against the so-called Darwinian evolution, the survival of the fittest. If that is the case, we should be using 100% of our DNA just to throw it into the pot. Okay, and so it goes. So what's happening is that you cannot stop this growth of consciousness. It is exploding around the world. People are waking up every morning and suddenly finding that they've got new abilities. They can see more things. They can hear more things. They feel more things that are going on. They're switching on and realizing that maybe they were a bit stupid about this or that, understanding more stuff. And that is called the global rise of consciousness.
That's some of the people who are listening to this show. That's some of the people who write stuff on the internet and maybe write books if they feel so inclined. But that's by no means all of the people.
No, you're wrong there, unfortunately, and I must correct you there. That is everyone in the world, except, again, this is a scientific fact. You can't stop this. It's the light that comes to us from the sun and from the galactic center. Okay, and specific times of the day or night when we are exposed to the galactic center, the parts of the planet, those people that live there are more exposed to this than the people on the other side of the planet. It's unstoppable, and you can't stop it. And the Anunnaki can't stop it. Those that control this world can't stop it. They try to stop it by introducing technological devices like microwaves and things like that that interfere with these frequencies. And other technology, HARP is a good example, and so forth. HARP can try and stop it by shooting certain frequencies into our atmosphere and activating the ozone layers so that they prevent some of these frequencies from reaching us. And as if this sounds far-fetched to you and some of your listeners, wake up, pay attention. This is not far-fetched. This is what's happening all the time.
All right, let's assume, Michael, that everybody buys into this. Let's assume that they turn off America's Got Talent or X Factor up here in the UK or Pop Idol or whatever else they're watching, and they decide, yep, we are more enlightened, we've discovered these new ways of doing things that, you know, they're very ancient, they've always been around, and now we've got them again, and we're going to be really powerful. What kind of a world do we end up with? What's going to happen?
It's a very important question, and one I want to spend a little bit of time with you, because it's very important. But before I get there, Howard, I just want to finish quickly with this reawakening, the activating of the DNA, because that also affects what the ancients called the third eye, your pineal gland. The fact that our pineal gland does not work is clear indication is that it's been switched off by genetic manipulation. The genes that control our pineal gland to do what it's supposed to do, to act like our third eye and be the receptor of all the other frequencies than the visible light seen by our eyes, is a clear indication that our DNA has been messed with. But once again, this unstoppable wave of evolution that's reaching us from the galactic center is activating our DNA, switching on certain genes that is reactivating our pineal gland. So when I say when people wake up every morning with new abilities, they ability to extrasensory perception, to more paranormal abilities, to feel things and hear things and sense things that they were not able to sense before. And that's because of the reactivation of our pineal gland.
Okay, well, I haven't told this story before, and I wasn't going to tell this story because I thought, well, I don't know how it would affect my credibility, and I'm trying to stay journalistically detached. And I wasn't. All right, I'll tell the story. I woke up on the morning that England got knocked out of the World Cup in South Africa. This might sound trivial to you, but it really shocked me on that day. And for a long time afterwards, I was transfixed and not knowing what I could do with this information. And up until now, I haven't told the story. I woke up and I sensed what the result would be, and that there would be one disputed goal. Now, I'm not interested in particularly football. I don't follow football, haven't since I was a boy, but was very proud of South Africa for what happened in the World Cup. But I woke up at 7 a.m. with the result of the match, and rationally I thought, that is a load of rubbish. That can't be right. I turned onto the match in the afternoon here in the UK, and exactly what I had suspected and what I had been told or woken up with happened. Now, I don't know what that was. Is that an example of that thing you're talking about? And this is, I swear, on a stack of Bibles, on my dear mother's memory, on anything that I hold dear, that is a true story. Is that an example of what you've just been telling me about?
I'm very glad that I pulled it out of you. And let that be an example to many others that this is happening on a very, very large scale, whether you're aware of it or not. And yes, it is a very good example of that.
Why couldn't they have given me the lotto numbers? Well, why couldn't they give me something I could go out and use? I suppose I could have phoned a bookie on that day and made a bet on the match. But I just thought it was so ridiculous that I dismissed it until it happened.
And this is where the consciousness thing becomes so beautifully important. Because consciousness, this thing called consciousness that we've really struggled to define, and I'm not going to define it on the show because there's not enough time, because I can't really define it, so I'd rather tell you what it is not, okay, based on much research, much research by others.
Okay.
Yeah. So this whole thing called consciousness loves this the thing that happened to you, and you know, you said, well, why can't I know the lotto numbers? Because that's exactly what it is not. It is not about benefiting you as an individual. It's about making decisions and doing things, individuals that do things that benefit greater communities and humanity as a whole, people that start those kind of actions and those kind of movements will see greater and greater results, positive results. That's what this consciousness thing is all about. And it's drawing people together in a way that no one has ever possibly imagined. What's also important about what you said, your premonition, right, is also, it also just supports the scientific experiments that have been done and now are scientifically accepted as proof of this thing called non-locality, or how everything is connected and that past, present and future are all happening at the same time, but we in this physical, three-dimensional physical world are not really aware of it because we're living on the wrong side of space-time and time-space. We're living in space-time, and there's this very interesting thing in quantum physics, and this is when quantum physicists suddenly become the greatest supporters of the concept of God, the greatest sort of divine being, because that's what the quantum physics results keep telling us, that there's some sort of a weird divine structure and a reason for all of this stuff. And, you know, for many years, science was always used as these cold, hard, factual arguments that God does not exist. Well, suddenly that's no longer the case.
Well, there are many things that work. I mean, they work in my own life, and they probably work in your life. Well, you wouldn't be doing it in, you know, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if they didn't work in your own life. But sometimes if I feel down about stuff, I'll feel impelled to go and drive to Stonehenge, which is about an hour and a half from where I live. It's an easy drive, and it's a really nice place to go. And, you know, once you've seen the stones, you've seen the stones. But I have to go back there because I always come back, and I always think, well, it's just because you've had a day out, Howard. I always come back feeling a hell of a lot better. From what you're saying, maybe there's a much bigger reason for why I feel better after a trip to Stonehenge than I've ever thought before.
Well, absolutely, and you've put your finger right on the crux of the matter, because Stonehenge is probably one of the earliest sites built by the Anunnaki. It was a very powerful energy-generating device. My take on Stonehenge from my recent visit there in May is that it's probably about 450,000 years old, and it's a very simple observation. I can't believe no one's ever seen this before. It is just, I'm dumbfounded, okay? And I'll explain to you why I say it's that old. It's very simple. And every geologist that I shared with this said, well, it's so obvious. Of course it is. So I'd love to share this with the audience. But before we get there, once again, many people experience that we take to the stone ruins here in Southern Africa, including the wonderful Kerry Cassidy from Project Camelot. They come out of the tours and have a profound life-changing experience. They tell me that they feel rejuvenated. They feel as if their DNA has been reactivated in some way. Mm. And they tell you these amazing stories that I just go, well, you know what? If that works for you, that's fantastic. And I didn't understand it until we started measuring the real frequencies that are coming out of these stone circles. Now I understand that it's not just their imagination, it's real. It's really happening. And that's what happened to you at Stonehenge. The same thing. Stonehenge is a very powerful energy generating device. And all you need to do is find a friend somewhere in the UK that's got a machine that can measure frequencies. And I suggest you look at a machine called the Horizon, because it measures from 0 hertz to about 375 gigahertz, which is, you know, right at the top end. And you will find very interesting frequencies at Stonehenge. Just to tell you why I think Stonehenge is so old is, first of all, if the stones were chosen for their acoustic properties, which we are told they were, to generate sound, they would have been. They would not have chosen stones that had any blemishes or cracks, especially cracks in them. Well, if you look at some of those stones, many of them have very large cracks right through the stones, with erosion in those cracks that is absolutely unthinkable. The one main stone that has fallen, the tall one in the middle that has fallen over and broken into three pieces. I work with rocks every day. I know what a broken rock looks like and the relatively fresh broken edges. And I know what 50,000 and 100,000 and 200,000 year old erosion on stone looks like. Well, that stone that broke off and broke into pieces, those edges, it doesn't even look like one stone. The erosion on those broken edges is so severe that why no one has picked this up before just blows my mind.
So these rocks have been tuned just like a tuning fork.
Correct. They were tuned originally to create a harmonic sound frequency in a circle, and that's why they build it in a circle, because you create what's known as a standing wave, and it's unstoppable. Once you create a standing wave inside a circle that's a self-generating organism, basically, that you're looking at, it's just unstoppable. You've got this constant source of very powerful energy.
Well, that's been the dream thing for so many scientists for so many years, the standing wave being used to generate inexhaustible power.
Exactly, and that's what you had at Stonehenge, and you still have this in the stone circles here in Southern Africa. And then on Stonehenge, one of those lintels, the cross beams that link, you know, across the big standing stones, you know, if you're going to drag a lintel for 300 miles to put it across two big stones, you're certainly not going to choose a lintel with a large crack through it, okay? Mm. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think my logic is pretty sound here.
Well, you'd take it back to the builder's merchant and get one that didn't have a crack, unless you meant it that way.
Yeah, and I don't think they meant it that way, especially if they, you know, if they dragged it for so long, they would have taken a beautiful, pristine, you know, whole stone. Well, one of those lintels across has got a huge crack through it. Now, you may argue that that crack only happened, you know, after they put it up. Yes, it did happen after they put it up. And that's when you look at the erosion around the crack. The erosion around the crack is about 10 centimeters deep. That kind of erosion to happen in that stone will take hundreds of thousands of years. So we have a very strong scientific and geological argument that Stonehenge is probably around 500,000 years old. And anything else, any other argument, is purely just not good enough.
Well, wow. All amazing stuff, Michael. You put a very, very good case forward. I hate to do this to you. We've got about 2 minutes to wrap it all up. So what do you want to say to conclude this? You know, how will you sell? America is the country of selling. I've got a lot of listeners right across America, right from coast to coast and all the other bits of the USA. Very grateful to have them. You're going to have to put a selling message together. Sell me what you're going to tell them.
Well, I'm going to expose them to the evidence of the first civilization on Earth, the first humans on Earth that lived in Southern Africa mining gold, proof of genetic cloning, proof of evidence of gold mining, and then the destruction of this civilization that simply vanished. Show them absolutely staggering evidence from beautiful photographs, aerial photographs, and stone tools and artifacts that we've collected, and show how this has led to who we are today as a civilization, and how we are still being controlled and manipulated. And we better wake up, smell the coffee, and start taking back what's been taken from us as the human race. We're all one. We all come from the divine creation, and we've been manipulated to believing we're separate, and we've been, you know, spurred to fight each other and non-stop conflict, and that needs to change.
I think you're going to get a lot of coverage in the US. When is the first date, and where is it?
I start in New York on the 26th of August, and I'm on a 2-full-month tour of the United States, right across the United States. If people want to go onto hopefully your website, if you can show them, and my website, which is ZuluPlanet.com and SlaveSpecies.com, actually, SlaveSpecies.com, and go onto that website, and the information of my tour, all the dates and venues are there. You can book your ticket on PayPal, and I hope to see many people there to share this exciting information with them.
Your enthusiasm, just as it was as I sat in that apartment in Sandton, Johannesburg, a couple of years ago, your enthusiasm, Michael, is infectious and very dynamo-like. So I can only say I hope it goes really well. And as you say in South Africa, when you meet somebody, you say, how's it? And at the end of your conversation, or when you've had your chat with an old friend, you say, go well. So I'm going to say to you, go well, and report back to me. You know, as ever, fascinating conversation, amazing to listen to, and I can only wish you the very, very best in the United States, Michael.
Thank you very much, Howard, and I look forward to chatting again.
I'll see you at Stonehenge.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care, Michael. You've been hearing Michael Tellinger, the compelling words thereof, here on The Unexplained, live from South Africa on a digital hookup. Amazing what technology can do, isn't it? 2 years ago, I sat in his apartment with a mini disc recorder doing that interview, and today I'm here in London and he's there in Mpumalanga, which I can assure you is a very beautiful and quite eye-opening part of South Africa. If you get the chance to see SA, try and go to Mpumalanga. You know, it's worth it, definitely. Okay, thank you very much for your great feedback. Please keep it coming. You can email me via the front page of this website. Keep the donations coming, please. We need the money to keep this vital work going and to develop it. Thank you to Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool for getting this show out to you and for doing things like Devise, the new function that allows you to listen to this show on the iPhone 4 or the iPod Touch. So that's available to you. Thank you to Martin for the theme tune. And as I say, thank you to you for keeping the faith with this show and for listening to The Unexplained. My name is Howard Hughes. This has been Edition 41, and we will return soon. Take care.